Welcome to the 300 to 350 show. Well, we're following the world's progress towards the UN climate talks in Copenhagen at the end of the year. In this programme, we aim to open the window a bit wider on the status of the talks, now that there's just three more negotiating weeks to go before the talks begin in Copenhagen on 7th of December. It's difficult to overstate the importance of getting a global climate deal in Copenhagen. What's at stake is nothing less than our ability to keep climate change from running out of control and causing irreparable damage to the environment on which we all depend. As an international community, we've known about this problem for a long time. As part of the rich minority, we've failed to act adequately on our 1992 commitment under the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change to take the lead in protecting the climate system for the benefit of future generations. At even this late stage in the game, we are still trying to pin the blame on rapidly developing nations with large populations, such as China and India, while doing as little as possible ourselves. We are also ignoring our obligation under the UN Climate Convention to provide large-scale finance and technology in order to enable these countries to develop in a low-carbon way and to protect them from the impact of climate change, which they themselves did very little to create. As the rich world inevitably controls and spins the media debate, here on the 300 to 350 show, we endeavour to go behind the headlines by looking at what the majority poor world is saying, and by referring to what the 192 countries of the UN are actually saying when they sit down together at the talks. So stick with us for the next half an hour, and we hope you'll get a more accurate and substantive picture of what's happening in the negotiations than you would from numberless mainstream news bulletins. So let's briefly revisit first principles. If the global climate deal is not based on the latest science, it will not deliver the ultimate objective of the UN Climate Convention, which is to avoid dangerous climate change. The first myth that the rich world is peddling is that there is a scientific and political consensus around limiting global temperature rise to no more than 2 degrees centigrade. Here's UK Environment Secretary Ed Miliband doing just that at a joint press conference with his brother, UK Foreign Secretary David Miliband, on the 8th of September.
What are the ingredients of a global deal? Because this is a very important question. First of all, consistency with the science. At the L'Aquila summit in July, the 17 leading major economies of the world came together and signed up to what had already become a scientific consensus, but made it a political consensus, that we should limit temperature increases to a maximum of 2 degrees.
As we recently showed on this programme, using powerful and incontrovertible testimony, this is simply not true. The Obama-convened Major Economists Forum that Ed Miliband refers to represents just 39 countries, and there are 192 countries involved in the UN climate talks. More than 80 of these countries now agree that global warming should be limited to as far below 1.5 degrees C as possible. The 2 degrees C target is based on science that is more than 16 years old, and the latest IPCC report shows that serious impacts are now expected to occur at even lower temperature thresholds. Even the European Union's Commissioner for the Environment has now acknowledged that 2 degrees C is not enough to, in his words, avoid negative, catastrophic and irreversible impacts. He now believes that keeping global warming below 1.5 degrees C is a better guide for policy. The same 80-plus countries have also adopted the latest science from leading climate scientist James Hansen of NASA and his team, that we should aim to keep greenhouse gas concentrations in the atmosphere as far below 350 parts per million carbon dioxide equivalent as possible. The chair of the UN Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, Rajendra Pachauri, has also recently endorsed this target in a personal capacity. The same 80-plus countries have also acknowledged that the science says that we need to peak global emissions as soon as possible, but certainly by 2015. and they suggest that a global cut in emissions of more than 85% by 2050 is consistent with this target. These countries are the Association of Small Island States and the Least Developed Countries, and they represent those nations that are experiencing the impacts of climate change first and worst. Rightly enough, they want to protect their right to survival and put a cap on the impacts that they are already suffering. The US, EU and Japan are not only keen on using the outdated, dangerous temperature threshold of 2 degrees, they also support a global cut in emissions of 50% by 2050, which has virtually no chance of staying within this target. The most recent Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change report back in 2007 suggests that we need reductions of greenhouse gas emissions of more than 85% by 2050 compared to 2000 levels to keep within 2 degrees centigrade. Put another way, the top-line ambition of the rich world is almost certain to lead to uncontrollable runaway climate change. How many days do we have left before Copenhagen? How many days do we have left for the citizens of the United States, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, Japan and Russia to put the fire under the asses of their elected representatives? How many days do we have left before our newspapers, TV and radio stop recycling the rich world spin unquestionably? Less than 80. We're going to take a short musical break now and then come back to the question of fairness.
Each and every one of us shall pay on demand. A part of sacrifice. Knowing that all together we're getting ever closer to the new being. Whose figure is about to appear? Whose figure is about to appear?
was Mark Stewart and the pop group from way back when with Where There's a Will. The largest group of countries by far at the UN talks is the G77 plus China bloc, which represents over 130 developing world nations. It's a dauntingly large number of countries to achieve agreement amongst, so when they do talk as one, the world should be listening. Here's Bernarditas Muller of the Philippines delegation speaking on behalf of the G77 plus China.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. I hope you understand that the task of consolidating 132 countries is not an easy one. And in fact, if we get consolidated among us within the group of developing countries, I think very much of the text would also move forward, because we have, of course, in a spirit of cooperation, made all of us submissions, groups of members, particular members of the group and the group itself in general. And therefore, I feel a serious responsibility to help you in the process, to help all of us move forward in the process, to coordinate all the texts of the G77 members together and to have a unified position, I think, in any kind of negotiations. When the developing countries have all put forward unified positions, that is when we really start moving forward, especially in this process.
At the most recent week of talks in Bonn, these countries laid out their view of what should constitute the shared vision of a global climate deal. The G77 plus China are not yet prepared to even talk about a global goal for emissions reductions until they are given assurances that the overall deal will be a fair one. Understandably, they need assurances that the burden for making emissions cuts will not fall unfairly on them when they still have basic needs to meet, and they need to know that the rich world will finally come good on their long-standing commitments on finance and technology. So, for the G77 plus China, the shared vision needs to encompass the four building blocks of finance, technology, adaptation, and mitigation. The sharing of actions between countries should be based on the principles of equity and common but differentiated responsibilities, as laid out in the UN Framework Convention. And, as mandated by Article 4.7 of the UN Climate Convention, the extent of developing country actions is dependent on the amount of finance and technology support provided by the developed world. For the G77 plus China, the right, quote, to enable economic development to proceed in a sustainable manner, end quote, is, quote, an article of faith, end quote. Their proposal for the shared vision is asking nothing more than is already in the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change and the Bali Action Plan, under which these talks are taking place. 13 years. So, onto that question of what would constitute fairness in the global deal on climate change. We've dealt with this before on the 300 to 350 show, but it's important to revisit now as the G77 plus China view on this starts to crystallise. The UN Climate Convention talks about the twin principles of equity and common but differentiated responsibilities and respective capabilities. And it's hard to find any party to the talks who won't at least pay lip service to these principles, as doing so would contravene the convention. So if we could only determine what these phrases mean in practice, they might turn into something that could be used as a guide to action and to afford agreement. To help make progress on these absolutely central questions, a special session was held at the talks in Bonn back in June to allow parties to share views on the definition of historic responsibility. 7 presentations were given, which gave different interpretations on the same question, and significantly, no one presented an argument that seriously undermined the appropriateness of using historic responsibility or equity as a guide to apportioning future action. Equity essentially means equality, and in the context of the talks, equity has come to mean the idea that everyone has an equal limitation on their right to pollute the atmosphere, or, Put another way, everyone has an equal share of what is considered to be the safe greenhouse emissions budget. Or, everyone has an equal right to the atmospheric space. Equity is also strongly associated with Aubrey Myers' proposal of contraction and convergence that has, over the years, gained a high level of support. In 2000, Meyer was able to claim support for contraction and convergence from India, China, and many African countries. The problem is that the rich world has already used up their fair share of the atmospheric space, and they are now in debt. So when considering how to apportion the rights to the remaining safe emissions budget based on historic responsibility, the rich world has to quickly move into a position where its domestic emissions are less than zero. This is clearly not possible. The most that a country can reduce its emissions, even in theory, is to zero. But the rich world could meet its additional obligations by paying for emissions cuts in the developing world. This concept of negative emissions is now getting a wide traction. Outside the UN process, senior figures such as Sir Nicholas Stern and former chief advisor to the German government on climate change, John Schellenhuber, have both acknowledged the logic behind the need for negative emissions allocations for rich countries. The presentations by Martin Kaur of the South Centre and the country representatives of Bolivia, India and China all talked about equal access to the total safe emissions budget across time and the negative emissions allocations that this implies for rich countries. This understanding of equity and historical responsibility implies that rich country obligations in 2020 are much greater than has been previously thought. India, for example, has calculated that by 2020, the rich world would need to cut its emissions by 79.2%. This would include both domestic cuts and payment for cuts in poor countries abroad, and India has tabled this proposal formally at the talks. If we bear in mind that the EU is currently offering a cut of 20 to 30% by 2020, then clearly we have a long way to go. Ambassador Angelica Navarro of Bolivia presented the concept of climate debt during the exchange of views on historical responsibility. Here she is, outlining the scale of the task now ahead of us.
If we are to curb emissions in the next decade, we need a Marshall Plan for the Earth. This plan must mobilize financing and technology. It must get technology onto the ground, and we only have a decade to do that. Developed countries must lead by cutting their emissions very deeply to make space for developing countries. They must further accept that they have already used their fair share of the atmospheric space, and they may consider negative allocations, allocations that reflect their full historical responsibility. We will work with the developed countries' partners to live well within the Earth's limited remaining atmospheric space, to follow a path different from the path they follow, and to work together toward a future that protects our Mother Earth, Pachamama, and the well-being of all peoples. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And here's Martin Kaur, director of the South Centre, an intergovernmental organisation of developing countries, arguing for the need to go beyond the contraction and convergence idea of equal per person emissions rights.
Is per capita equity in emissions a correct goal? In the past, I thought so, but today I think not, because you can envisage an NX1 country going down to 1 ton per capita, say by the year 2050, and still retain $50,000 per capita income, because the NX1 country has the capacity, the technology, and the know-how, and the infrastructure to do this fantastic turnaround. But a developing country with 1 ton per capita emission may be stuck with $500 per capita income or $1,000 per capita income unless it undergoes a miraculous technology revolution. And therefore, NX1 has the advantage of past growth based on the abundant use of carbon, leading to greater infrastructure, technology, human and social capacity. It can do this turnaround. The developing countries no longer have the low-cost carbon resources to base its development, and therefore we have to use a multiplier to adjust for per capita emissions for developing countries in future discussion. In other words, if we have 1 ton as the average, then a developing country with 5 times less technology should be allowed 5 tons. And a developed country should not be allowed 1 ton, but should go negative into perhaps -3 tons per capita. Nicholas Stern, in his latest book, actually talks about the need for going negative per capita emissions for developed countries.
And on top of this emissions debt, the rich world owes an adaptation debt. Rich countries with just 20% of the world's population have produced more than 70% of greenhouse gas emissions. Yet the impacts are falling first and worst on the poor countries, which have done little to create the problem. Because of this historic responsibility for causing climate change, the rich must also shoulder the responsibility for compensating the poor world for losses suffered and to ensure that they can adapt to the unavoidable impacts of climate change. So what was the upshot of this exchange of views back in June in Bonn? Well, at the following set of talks in August, G77 plus China bloc said that the concept of historical responsibility should be part of a shared vision and should be used to help determine a fair sharing of agreed actions between countries. They invited parties to work further on this question and continue to flesh out the concept. That's about all we've got time for this week. We hope that we've helped pull into focus where the talks are currently at in terms of the science and fairness debates. These elements are key to unlocking the deal in Copenhagen, but are not sufficient in themselves. Over the coming week, we'll look at some of the other elements. How is the Global South suggesting that the transfers of technology and finance take place? What kind of sums are needed for adaptation, both now and in the future? And what are they needed for? What are the best solutions for bringing a halt to deforestation, which represents around 20% of global annual emissions? Over the next week or so, a number of meetings are coming up that are external to the UN process, but could have an impact on them. There will be meetings of the Major Economies Forum, a G20 finance meeting, and a special session of the UN General Assembly on Climate Change in New York. We'll do our best to assess the results of these meetings, and we'll also be looking at the mess that the US is getting itself into with its domestic climate change legislation. In the meantime, please visit the Climate Radio Archive, where you can get references for this week's programme, and hear the show again. You'll find it at www.climateradio.org. Thanks for listening.